You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In his first inaugural address in 1981, Ronald Reagan declared that government is not the solution to a problem, government is the problem. But during the 1980 campaign, billionaire David Koch, who was then living in a rent-stabilized New York City apartment, attacked President Reagan for offering no change whatsoever from Jimmy Carter and the Democrats. What ideas have prompted such claims, or the current of efforts of the Koch brothers? Duke University historian Nancy McLean traces the lineage of some of the most conservative political ideas, and especially the role of economist James M. Buchanan, in her new book called Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. It's published by Viking, and I'm very pleased that it brings Professor McLean to our show now. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
And during the time that Donald Trump has been in office, how stealthy has the radical right's plan for the United States been?
Well, this plan has been developing over many years. Charles Koch was reading radical right libertarian philosophers going back to the 1960s, and by his own accounting, he searched for decades and funded hundreds of intellectuals before he found the ideas that could get him what he wanted. He referred to them as a technology. He has 3 degrees from MIT, so he often thinks in those terms. But he found that at George Mason University, where a political economist named James McGill Buchanan, who had won the Nobel Prize in 1986, was working, and Koch made his first $10 million investment in 1997. And he said at that time that he wanted to unleash the kind of force that propelled Columbus. So he was very clear that he had a world-altering mission. He even compared himself to Martin Luther. So you get a sense of the grandiose nature, really, of the vision. It was a kind of a messianic vision. But from Buchanan, he got what he had not found elsewhere, and that was a set of ideas that would enable him to achieve the kind of society and the kind of government he wanted. Other people had outlined it, but Buchanan actually provided ideas that could inform a strategy. And ever since then, since 1997, Koch funded organizations, and there are quite literally hundreds of them at this point, you know, with monies from the Koch donor network. Those organizations have been working assiduously and have also effectively taken over the Republican Party and turned it into a delivery vehicle for this plan. And I just want to say something.
Is it just one plan?
Well, there are many aspects to this plan, but basically it's a plan to, as Buchanan used the phrase, enchain Leviathan. He referred to modern government as Leviathan, but he also spoke of the demos being unchained after the 18th century. So he was quite clear that his mission was to, in effect, protect capitalism, as he saw it, the best version, kind of pure capitalism, from government. So it is quite an audacious vision, and ultimately, it's a vision about changing the Constitution to lock in the kinds of changes that will proceed in other dimensions. But so it's a multifaceted plan. I mean, it's certainly not a single thing, and we see it spinning out in different ways in many states across the country, as well as the federal government and the courts and the law schools, some of the law schools of our nation. But I think it's fair to call it a plan, yes.
Reagan identified government as the problem, but the president and Congress are elected. So would that make democracy part of the problem in their eyes?
Well, that's a really crucial question, and that really gets to the heart of things. Yes. Reagan, it was interesting. James Buchanan included Ronald Reagan in his pantheon, a very small pantheon, but he included Reagan there because Reagan had such soaring rhetoric for the cause, and as you say, you know, also pithy comments like the one you just quoted about government being not the solution to our problem, but the problem. But actually, this cause was deeply disappointed in Ronald Reagan, and that's part of the reason it became radicalized later on. Reagan very quickly learned with his first budget, and David Stockman talked about it pretty brilliantly in his book at the time, Reagan learned that the kind of cuts he was talking about to promote this cause would not just harm the kind of people conservatives tend to think of, like, you know, sadly poor people, African Americans, et cetera, but actually it would require huge cuts to the Republican Party's own constituencies' favored programs such as Social Security and Medicare. I believe Stockman called it lethal war on the party's main constituencies. And seeing that, Reagan drew back and helped build up a huge deficit. But that was also a learning moment for Koch, for Buchanan, for these people on the radical libertarian right who began to realize, look, we are not going to win by working through the regular electoral system. What we need to do is change the rules. And Buchanan said that frequently. We can't just change the rulers. We must change the rules. So they began to do that in a highly sophisticated way in the late 1990s. And I'll just give you one example of that is the Club for Growth and now Freedom Partners. Those are big funds supplied by billionaire donors. And what they do is use their money to run primary challenges against any Republican who doesn't toe the line. So we now have this new verb, to be primaried. And when a candidate is primaried, either they're knocked out and a candidate more favorable to the cause is put in, more compliant, or they learn to comply. So it's a very sad thing. But some of our key leaders in Washington, including Orrin Hatch, was primaried and said, these people are not conservatives. They're radical libertarians. I can't stand these people. But Orrin Hatch blocked the appointment of Merrick Garland. So similarly, John McCain has been a very, very principled Republican through the years and has earned widespread respect for that. But he has also changed positions in response to this kind of threat. And the Koch Network actually calls this the secret sauce, the accountability play. And basically what they're doing is using those donor funds to make the Republican Party accountable, not to its own base, to its voters, but to the donors. And so you see that on issue after issue where the party is out of step with what its own long-term voters would like. And we could talk more about that if you would like.
Sure. Well, first, Trump advisor Steve Bannon has talked about deconstructing the administrative state. Does that fit in with Buchanan's thinking?
It does. It certainly does. Buchanan was a political economist trained at the University of Chicago, but who developed a very distinctive approach that instead of focusing on questions involving the market, focused on questions involving government. His specialty was public finance, and so he was particularly interested in questions of taxation, spending, and government debt. And his approach basically applied Chicago-style economics to model all political actors as really not concerned with the public interest or the common good at all. He denied that such a thing existed unless there was unanimity on a particular purpose. But instead, he said, all of these people are really just self-seeking. They're really just after their own interests. So in the case of politicians, that would be getting reelected. In the case of people running government agencies and what Bannon has called the deep state, that would mean expanding their agencies, increasing their budgets. Now, other empirically minded political scientists and economists have shown that actually this isn't true. It doesn't describe our system well, but it is a deeply ideological mission, and it has been communicated now over decades to many figures in the Republican Party, many figures in the corporate world. And so when Bannon says he wants to undermine the administrative state, he's very much speaking out of that set of ideas. Even when Trump says he wants to drain the swamp, he means something very different from what liberals imagine he means. He doesn't mean just corporate lobbyists. He also means the AARP, the labor union, civil rights groups, Planned Parenthood, all of those groups that look to government for any kind of assistance or programming that requires tax revenue are looked at by this cause as the swamp. And Buchanan, by his later years, described them as predators and parasites who prey on and exploit the wealthy. And this is a language that you can see now in libertarian organizations across the board, most notably the Cato Institute, which Charles Koch founded with James Buchanan's assistants in the 1970s.
Nancy McLean is our guest, professor of history at Duke University. Her book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. If Koch and others like him, them, are determined to change the rules, how far would they go to limit democracy? And do voters who are sympathetic to libertarianism realize how much the Kochs and others would limit democracy?
again, these are such important issues. I don't think many voters who are sympathetic to libertarianism understand the full extent of this. And in fact, Theda Scotch poll at the Kennedy School of Government and a colleague did a wonderful book on the Tea Party where they did more research at the grassroots, talked to more people than anyone else had. And what they found is not one single person at the grassroots who wanted to see Social Security privatized or Medicare privatized. And yet that's exactly what the Koch network is using the grassroots energies of the Tea Party to achieve ultimately, along with changing the Constitution. So it's quite a significant and radical vision.
Did the Buchanan come from farm country in Tennessee? Wouldn't government support for agriculture end if his ideas were implemented?
Government support for agriculture would most assuredly end if these ideas were implemented. And Buchanan, it is a very interesting story. Yes, he came from a farm family in Middle Tennessee, better off than most, but still, you know, everybody was struggling in the Great Depression when he was, you know, which was part of his formative years. He was born in 1919. And interestingly, his grandfather was elected governor of Tennessee by the populist movement of the 1890s, but he ended up disappointing his base. The main reason they elected him was because the coal companies were hiring convict labor and conscripting convict labor to do the work of free miners. And the free miners had organized in the United Mine Workers of America, and they were trying to stop this convict labor and get decent lives for themselves and their families. And so they became part of the farmers' movement that was you know, in the populist movement in Tennessee, and they elected Buchanan's grandfather on this platform. Buchanan's grandfather, however, was a wealthier farmer and also someone committed to low taxes and balanced budgets, and he ended up siding with the Tennessee Coal and Iron Company against the people who put him in office, and it was actually one of the biggest uprisings in the New South. It's a kind of a fascinating story in its own right, but he ended up being a one-term governor because of that rebellion against him and against the coal companies and their convict labor system, and he became a very bitter man after that by his grandson's telling, and often ruminated over what caused it. And the grandfather ended up supporting voter suppression in the South after that. And he also noticed that the sheriffs who were elected did not support him. They allied with the protesters. And that, I think, perhaps was a lesson to this the young Buchanan, that people who are elected will not do what they are supposed to do by law sometimes, or will not obey the higher officials because they are connected to the people. And that becomes a problem if you're trying to protect a very exploitative system like that convict labor system in Tennessee.
Now, Buchanan taught at the University of Virginia and then moved to George Mason. It's also a public university. Don't some conservatives oppose the existence of public universities? What did Buchanan think of working at public schools?
I'm so glad that you asked that. It's a huge irony in this story. Well, Buchanan actually had a scholarship to the University of Chicago after World War II. He had served in the Navy, and he had a scholarship that actually came out of, I think, Roosevelt's efforts to bring the South into the mainstream because, you know, it was so poor at the time. And Buchanan's scholarship required him to go back and teach in Southern public institutions. So he first taught in Florida and then in Tennessee and then at the University of Virginia and Virginia Tech and George Mason. So it's just a huge irony because this cause is deeply critical of public education. And Buchanan himself in Virginia in the late 1950s, as the massive resistors were fighting to stop the implementation of Brown versus Board of Education and trying to shift tax revenues to private segregated white schools, Buchanan essentially helped in that effort and even argued for the full privatization of Virginia schools, allegedly just on economic grounds, not on racial grounds, I should make clear. But then he went on to, in fact, he first got together with Charles Koch's organizations in the late 60s and early 1970s. Koch had something called the Center for Independent Education that was promoting private schooling around the country. So yes, it's a huge irony. And this cause today is working essentially to totally undermine our public education system because they are so deeply ideologically opposed to public education and supportive of private education, but also because they are very smart and very shrewd and very calculating, and they understand that, for example, organized teachers have been a huge political power supporting not only public education, but the rest of the liberal agenda, you know, in terms of things that people care about, whether it's Social Security protection or environmental protection or all these other kinds of things. Teachers have significant political clout. So for the cause, libertarian cause, undermining public education serves multiple purposes, and not least among them is taking out a really important adversary to clear the way for them to wield more power, while also shifting resources to the private education industry corporations, who can then become part of the lobbying force to push this further.
I'm speaking with Nancy McLean, who is the William H. Chafe Professor of History at Duke University. Her book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America, is published by Viking, and we will continue our conversation after this. We are back with Nancy McLean, the William H. Chafe Professor of History at Duke University. Her book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. It's published by Viking. Usually when we talk about the relationship between libertarians like the Kochs and the Mercers and the radical right, the name Ayn Rand comes up, not James Buchanan. Why is he so largely overlooked?
He never sought the limelight. It's very interesting. He found Milton Friedman kind of annoying. Milton Friedman was not his advisor at the University of Chicago. It was an earlier figure named Frank Knight, who was then a much bigger player than Friedman, who was young. But he took a disliking to Friedman.
Friedman's ideas are similar to his?
Well, they played on the same team. They were all part of a transnational, actually, invitation-only gathering, which Charles Koch ultimately joined, too, the Mont Pelerin Society that started in 1947 after World War II to promote what they called the Free Society. So they were all part of the same team, but, you know, as any cause, they had fallings out and jealousies and, you know, internal antagonisms. And they did have some different ways of seeing things. Both Buchanan and Koch thought that Milton Friedman was in some senses a sellout because he was often advising government on particular policies along the way and thinking that he could have influence, whereas Buchanan's approach was much more to operate, you could even say, more in the shadows. I mean, he was not a writer of the felicitousness of Milton Friedman. You know, his work was a little bit more abstract and dense. So that was one thing. But also he was not a particularly social individual, and he preferred to operate more in the shadows and actually communicate with powerful people, whether they're in the corporations that funded his various centers at Virginia or whether they were sympathetic political officials. He preferred to work that way. And he also did that because he saw the change as not being something that could be implemented immediately, but something that would take a few generations to lay the groundwork for. And in fact, he did that. You know, he set to work and created his first center at the University of Virginia in 1956. And it really wasn't until the 1990s that it began to have effect. For example, the Republican Revolution of 1994, you know, we tend to remember Newt Gingrich, but it was actually Dick Armey, who was much shrewder and much more the kind of military genius in that in Congress. And Armey was himself an economist who very much believed in Buchanan's public choice economics approach and was very much a kind of foot soldier for the cause. And so they made great headway then, but they still came up short and came up disappointed, which is why they radicalized and ultimately decided that they really needed to change the whole way the game is played and ultimately, again, the rules by changing the Constitution, which is really their end game.
And you mentioned public choice. Buchanan became a driving force behind what became known as public choice, the Public Choice School of Political Economy, or the Virginia School of Political Economy. At one point, wasn't the working title of your book, Forget Chicago, It's Coming from Virginia?
That was the title of a paper for a conference. But yes, I mean, one of the ways that I think about this is that, going back to your question, too, about Milton Friedman and Ayn Rand being better known, they were both figures who craved the limelight, who loved to be, you know, in the Klieg lights and getting attention. And again, Buchanan didn't do that. He was much more content to just make change behind the scenes. The way that I think about this is that Friedman and Rand's ideas were in some senses the ideas of the late 20th century, the kind of positive case for freeing markets and for, you know, in Friedman's terms, capitalism and freedom, whereas Buchanan's ideas are the ideas we've seen roll out in the 21st century that are much more about undermining the public sector, transforming the very operations of our democracy, you know, freeing corporate money for political speech, you know, all the thinking that went into Citizens United and calling corporate speech a First Amendment issue. That was coming out of the public choice group and out of Cato, for example. And ultimately, again, I think the mission is enchaining democracy. And I don't know if you would want to go into this, but I can say Buchanan had successful experience in that in Chile in 1980 when he was brought in to advise about the constitution that the Pinochet junta would use for its transition back to an electoral system. But it wanted to keep the changes it had made in place and insulate them from popular power to undo the fundamentals. And so Buchanan came in and advised on that. And they ended up with what a later leader called a constitution of locks and bolts. You know, we have prided ourselves on a constitution of checks and balances, but what this cause wants is a constitution of locks and bolts so that the majority of the people cannot affect change on things that they really care about through their government.
What did he make of the brutality of the Pinochet regime?
So interesting that you asked that. I really wanted to know that because this was a libertarian, you know, who had said from 1956 forward, when he set up his center, that he was devoted to the free society and he would speak in those terms. And yet, by the time he went to Chile, you know, it was an international scandal. It was the leading one of the most visible cases of human rights violations of the era. And universities were being purged. People had been killed. I mean, it's just all of this. In fact, they'd actually shot, they'd actually assassinated someone on the streets in Washington. So there was a U.S. government boycott against Chile at the time Buchanan went. And yet he went and he never spoke out against the violations of human rights there, or the brutality. And quite the contrary, all I could find in his papers was a letter to one of the top officials in the Pinochet junta, Sergio de Castro, thanking him for the dinner held in his honor, for the jewelry and given to his wife, Mrs. Buchanan, for the fine wines and the lovely trip. So there was absolutely no attempt to change the policies of this brutal dictatorship, and quite the contrary, applause for the way that it had freed the economy and freed, you know, essentially the very wealthy and corporate actors from accountability to democratic control. And actually what Buchanan did in Chile then made him a kind of hero in this Mont Pelerin society milieu, which Charles Koch was already a part of, and they featured him at their subsequent meetings in both California at the Hoover Institution and in Chile later that year.
Did Buchanan or the Virginia School of Political Economy work for any other countries?
Well, after he won the Nobel Prize in 1986, he was on the international circuit very often. I would say, too, here's another thing that's interesting about Buchanan. You know, whatever you would say about Milton Friedman, he did most of what he did right out in the spotlight. And I have been in Friedman's papers, and he answered every correspondent. He, you know, when he was criticized for going to Chile in 1975 to advise the junta on reducing inflation, he took responsibility for that. He explained himself. Buchanan, even though his mission then became what he called constitutional revolution, and he was determined to get the right constitution for the kind of libertarian economic liberty vision, he never spoke publicly about what he did in Chile. I saw that he reported it in his annual Vita supplement at Virginia Tech, you know, to show his growing international influence. But he never came clean with the public or wrote about what he did in Chile in his articles. So I think he was quite shrewd in understanding that this would not help him publicly, but through this Mont Pelerin Society and through these other transnational networks, he was able to provide advice. I mean, he was often invited, for example, to Eastern Europe after 1989. He was one of the people who went over, as did people from Cato and other institutions. He was often in East Asia. He went to other parts of Latin America. So he had quite an international following.
I'm speaking with Nancy McLean, whose book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America, is published by Viking. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. inequality has been growing for 40 years. What did Buchanan make of income and wealth inequality? Did he think inequality could limit economic liberty if the elite seek only to protect their wealth?
No, and this is another thing that I think distinguishes Buchanan's Virginia School from some in the Chicago school who were more interested in economic efficiency, whereas this Buchanan and Koch school is much more messianic. As near as I can tell, they don't seem to see inequality as a problem at all. In fact, the only time I ever heard Buchanan say anything seemingly sympathetic to African Americans was when he criticized the minimum wage and said, you know, this is a terrible thing for the teenage black, those were his words, that we shouldn't have minimum wages because that would keep people who were more vulnerable in the labor market from getting access to work in the only way he thought they could get access, which was at the lowest rungs, at the lowest cost. So this cause really celebrates the kind of inequality that we have now, as near as I can tell. I mean, they believe that the people who have succeeded, who are extremely wealthy, have achieved that by their own genius, their own sense of the market, their own accomplishments, whereas those who fall by the wayside really deserve that. And in fact, one of Buchanan's more famous papers was called The Samaritan's Dilemma. It was written in 1975, and it's informed conservatives and so-called conservatives and Republicans since, most famously Charles Murray, who didn't credit Buchanan but used his ideas. He argued in The Samaritan's Dilemma, he basically took the parable from the Bible of Jesus talking about the help given to the Samaritan and turned it on its head. And basically said, no, it's a mistake to help people who are in trouble because you may be creating perverse incentives for them that would not enable them to get back on their feet again. And so basically he was saying, you know, Jesus was wrong. Jesus was sort of a sop, or at least Jesus's ideas don't fit in the 20th century, because in the 20th century, we must realize that we must keep at bay these predators who are coming after our wealthiest citizens and seeking to exploit them. So it's pretty breathtaking stuff, you know, and I think that's also takes us back to something that you said in your framing about these people being conservative or very conservative. You know, this cause now flies under the banner of conservatism because it knew there was a great mass of people in America who understood themselves as conservatives, and that's the only way it could get something of a popular base to push its vision through. But in fact, all of these people at the outset were quite clear that they didn't want to be called conservatives. Charles Koch didn't want that. Friedrich Hayek didn't want that. James Buchanan didn't want that. They understood that they were radicals of the right and that they were interested in demolition, really, not conservation.
Well, how would Buchanan change the Constitution?
Oh, well, he did that in Chile. There are many ways that they will do that. And I think listeners, particularly in a place like New York, should be aware of kind of what's going on out in the other states of the country, like mine in North Carolina. There are 25 states now that are wholly controlled at every level by this radicalized Republican Party. And by that, I mean both houses of the legislatures and the governorship. And in those states, they have been pushing through radical changes at breakneck pace. You know, just recently it was in the news, just, you know, yesterday and today, about the Republican Party in Congress wanting to push through health care without hearings, without a CBO score, without all of these standard elements of good governance. Well, they've been doing that in places like North Carolina and Kansas for a good while now. So they've already built up half of the states, in this network. They need, I believe it's 8 more to get to a constitutional convention, which we have not had since 1787. I know this probably sounds crazy to some of your listeners, and I'm sorry about that. I'm a historian, you know, this is carefully researched and documented, but this is reality. This is a really radical cause. It's not like anything we've ever seen in this country before, or as near as I can tell, any other country. And it is really dead set on fundamentally changing the rules of our society. So you ask, how could they do that? So they're building towards this constitutional convention using a change that has polled well and been popular, a balanced budget amendment, which almost went through in the 1980s, but was defeated by one vote. So that's the lead item. But the fact is, constitutional scholars are saying, look, we haven't had a constitutional convention since 1787. You know, once you get people there, there's no telling what will happen. And I think people need to be aware that this highly organized network that has invested more money in its operations than either of our major political parties, you know, is likely to be running the show should such an event happen. But even in the meantime, they are radically changing the rules in various states. For example, in my own state, they want to put the right to work into the North Carolina Constitution. Now, why would you do that? We have the least unionization of any state in the country. It's not like there's, you know, raging strikes or unrest from organizing. But what this cause knows is that they are very not popular. Their goals are not popular. They know they're a minority movement. That's why they're operating this way. So they want to get things into constitutions so that they will not be able to be taken away later, or they'll only be able to be taken away with supermajorities.
And then the Wisconsin Assembly just Wednesday voted to call for a national constitutional convention about balancing the federal budget. We're pretty much out of time, but Buchanan was still alive during the bailout of Wall Street, and a caller wonders what he thought of it. Was it welfare for the rich?
Good question. Here's an interesting thing, is that people from his institution, the Mercatus Center, Dick Armey, Phil Graham in the Senate, they pushed through financial deregulation. So these are people who helped bring us the financial crisis by the legislation they pushed, but rather than taking responsibility for it, questioning their ideas, instead they pushed harder and blamed it on others. So definitely the Koch network was very angry about the bailouts. You know, Charles Koch believes that everybody should sink. You know, if a business fails, it should sink. And he's actually said a failing business, the head of a failing business should become a worker or a janitor, signaling to us, I think, what he thinks of workers and janitors, that somehow it's a life sentence. This is, I regret that this may sound so radical and maybe only almost kind of wacky to your listeners, but this is really serious stuff. I've been researching this for 10 years, and there were times when I felt like Claire Danes, you know, on the Homeland, where I was getting into this stuff, and I just couldn't believe what I was seeing, and I started to doubt myself. But I finally, when I got into Buchanan's papers in his archives at George Mason, there it was, all documented and laid out. So I think that we are at a historic fork in the road in our country, and whether or not we pay attention to this will determine what happens for the next few generations, what kind of society we will be, the world we'll bequeath to our children. I think this could not be more serious than it is.
And one of the interesting aspects of this is that the Kochs are actually critical of President Trump. It's the Mercers who are supporting him. So are we still in a state of flux in terms of what might happen, whether we might have people really pushing for this night watchman state where government provides little more than security and legal protections for property mostly?
Well, you know, Leonard, that's so interesting because, yes, Charles Koch did make a show of calling Donald Trump a monster at some point, and they didn't put money into the presidential election. On the other hand, if you watch more closely, they have managed, whether by agreement or substitute, but they have people who have come out of this cause very close to Trump, including Vice President Mike Pence, the White House Director of Legislative Affairs, Mark Short, comes out of Freedom Partners, where he served for 5 years heading that. Scott Pruitt has been part of this, Scott Pruitt at the EPA. And also, if you look at what Trump is really pushing through, it's less the things that he promised, the populist, you know, items that he promised to his voters, and much more the kind of things that the Koch donor network wants, like the elimination of Obamacare, like the deregulation, like the, you know, opening things up for the fossil fuel industry. So I really think that historians and journalists need to stop assuming there's a clear, bright line between the Koch network and the Trump administration and start asking harder questions about how, in fact, the Kochs are getting so much done in this new Trump administration while we're all listening to Donald Trump's tweets and imagining that he's an incompetent. And I don't know about him personally, but I know he's got some very talented people near, you know, in his administration who I believe think this is a good agenda, this one that's come out of the public choice people at George Mason and the Mercatus Center and the Koch network. So we'll see what happens, but I think much harder questions need to be asked.
Nancy McLean's book, is called Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. It's published by Viking. She's the William H. Chafe Professor of History at Duke University. And I thank you so much for being on our show.
I thank you. I've really enjoyed talking with you.